I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Welcome to a new episode of Be Good and Rewatch It. We actually have a title. We're on our own feed. Go to that
feed.
Hell
yeah.
You know, rewatch those episodes. Get those numbers up. Leave a
Patrick,
review.
We have a hard out.
You know what? The hard out is when I, you know, the twist is we don't have a hard out in a very M.
That's
Night
the
Shyamalan
M. Night
fashion.
Twist, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it turns out we have the room forever.
And no spoilers.
That would be a great twist, actually. If you were like, psych, you guys actually own that room, and here's another $50,000 to build it out the way you want to. That'd be fantastic. Great twist, M. Night.
Thanks.
Second twist. None of that's true.
Great twist, M. Night.
M. Night.
Stop it. Okay, well,
you know,
unfortunately, we're joined by Austin Walker.
That's me. Can I give you my thesis real quick?
Stop. Yeah. Okay, yep, sure. Go ahead.
David Cage wishes he was M. Night Shyamalan. That's my thesis. Going
David
back
Fincher?
To no, David Cage. David Cage. This movie made me realize that David Cage has, for 15 years, been trying to be M. Night Shyamalan. Down to Philadelphia, down to the way his shots look, everything. Down to the way he uses sexual assault as a quick and dirty way to vilify people. It's exactly it. Prove me wrong, internet.
Damn.
Well, only set one game in Philly, right?
So far.
Yeah, but everything else tracks.
This could be the beginning of his Detroit trilogy. You know, you never know.
Yeah. Oh, God.
Also joined by Natalie Watson.
Yep, that's me. Hey,
what's the first part in your notes again?
Oh, I was just going to say that the first two lines in my notes are Bruce Willis is hot. And then the second line in my notes is JK, I hate him.
Rob's
at me. Hey, what's up?
You got nothing, though?
Nothing? Really?
I was actually just cringing inward. I was reliving that moment where that poor woman sits down on the train next to Bruce Willis.
Oh,
and
my God.
He's just giving off desperate divorce da vibes right and left. Just, what luck.
It's my lucky day.
We are here to rewatch or have rewatched Unbreakable, the 2000 M. Night Shyamalan film. We were spurred to watch this because M. Night has a new film coming out this weekend called Glass, which is the part of essentially a trilogy set within a sort of shared universe of Unbreakable, Split, and Glass. So to set this up. We're going to spoil everything. If you haven't listened to a podcast of these before, we're just up front. We're not going to do a spoiler section. It's just, you know, it's the movie. So Unbreakable is a superhero origin story. It's kind of sort of, you know, what if Superman didn't know if he was Superman? The powers aren't the same, but, you know, same sort of premise. Bruce Willis plays David Dunn, a former football player turned security guard who's married to Audrey Dunn, played by Robin Wright, who looks exactly the same now as she did then. Remarkable. She has her own superpower. The marriage isn't going well. They're on the verge of separation when David is one of a dozen victims in a train accident. Dozens of victims. 131 people will die, except David. He's the sole survivor. He's
miraculous.
Soon contacted by
sole survivor.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I've been looking for those three words. Miraculous sole survivor.
The words of Elijah Price, who's the owner of a high-end comics art gallery, who theorizes that David is something. That's sort of something that the movie begins to explore. Elijah himself has a rare condition that makes his bones incredibly brittle. As a child, he was dubbed by kids who were making fun of him, Mr. Glass, because often his bones were breaking at sort of the slightest fall. David thinks Elijah's theory about him being some sort of metahuman, you know, there's no sort of exact phrasing, but something beyond normal human condition is bullshit. But over the course of the movie, maybe comes to suspect that Elijah is onto something. So for just a little context, this movie came out in 2000. So it's like after 1989 Batman, after 1978 Superman, sort of like the first major breakthroughs for comic book adaptations on like well-known properties. It's after a series of adaptations that probably a lot of people, especially when you were younger, didn't necessarily realize were based on a comic, because it's not like it was, now it's like trendy to say based on a comic. That was not the case with like The Crow in 94 or Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles in 90. I, for the longest time, had no idea that Turtles was based on a comic, and also that the comic was like super fucking dark and not lighthearted and fun and let's just eat pizza. Judge Dredd in 95, Men in Black in 97, and then Blade, which is sort of like a seminal comic book adaptation breakthrough, was only 2 years before. And this is 2000, the same year as X-Men. And it's, in my head, this movie came out after Spider-Man, because of course they're looking for different types of superhero movies. Like, nope, like this movie came out before Spider-Man. It's 5 years before Batman Begins and 8 years before Iron Man and sort of the MCU kicks off with all that. And so it's, you know, comic book movies existed, but it's not like this cultural dominant force where studios were looking to make comics. It was just more that, kind of in the same way that they mine video games, it's like, well, they're a thing that have stories, so occasionally one got adapted and sometimes they were popular. And then the other context is sort of the writer-director M. Night Shyamalan. So this movie comes out after his like breakout hit, The Sixth Sense, a movie with a really unforgettable
twist. No spoilers.
No one tell anyone, because Natalie has not seen it, and it, that's amazing that she's not gotten through cultural osmosis, so let her, you're gonna
have
to fix
this soon. I didn't
even
know there was a twist.
Well, that's what, okay. The trope of M. Night Shyamalan movies is that...
The internet is a bad place.
Yeah, you're going to get spoiled on this immediately. You have
no
to watch
one
it tonight.
No one spoil me. Okay, God.
Watch it tonight, this weekend. Like, fix it quick. Because also, if you were just to Google M. Night Shyamalan, like, it's... The notion of a twist is, like, a huge part of... It first became one of the things you looked forward to, then became, like, this trope and a trick that...
There was an entire episode of Entourage about it.
Yes.
True.
So... Sixth Sense came after two movies I've never seen, Praying with Anger, Wide Awake. He co-wrote the fucking Stuart Little adaptation with Michael J. Fox as the small mouse.
Huh. That's incredible to me.
Hugh Laurie's in that too, I think.
He plays the father. I watched this recently because it was on Netflix and you're always looking for new movies to watch with your kid.
Sure.
apparently, controversially, Ghost wrote the 1999 teen comedy She's All That with Freddie Prinze Jr. and Rachel Leigh Cook.
Wow.
Because the person who's credited with it claims he didn't, but M. Night claims that he did. Sure.
Hmm.
After Unbreakable, he does the alien invasion movie Signs, which is an all-time favorite of mine. The ending's goofy, but
I've seen
goddamn,
that
movie has a really fucking effective scenes that I still think about to this day. Birthday scene is amazing. The really weird, but weirdly underrated movie, The Village, because it has a terrible second half.
It's a terrible first second half.
Terrible. But if you were to chop that movie, just get rid of it.
I may have
movie
had a fades
to black
because of that movie. I predicted what the twist was in that movie and told my then girlfriend at the time. And when
You guys watched it?
Yeah, I was like, all right.
That's Chappie the Village?
But before it started, by like 2 months, she was really excited about it. And
you're
I
like, oh,
her,
I bet it's.
Yeah, I was right. And she was furious. And that is when I was like, and she was furious in a way that was not healthy. There was, like, that was not a healthy, response.
Retaliation.
Yes. And so afterwards, it didn't break us up. It was one of the things
a
that
flash
made
point.
Me go, huh, this is, huh, maybe this isn't right. Maybe this shouldn't happen.
Thanks, Manite.
Thank you, Manite Shyamalan.
Rob,
did you nail The Village because... like parts of Pennsylvania are like,
yeah, 100%.
Just, you're
I'm
more aware
North
of them. You're just like, oh,
yeah.
I know what this could be.
Yes, 100%. 100%.
That movie has a great first half. It's a very tense first half until it all falls apart. And then the second half sort of undermines any appreciation you had for what came before that. It has the weird movie aimed at like taking down film critics as they started to turn on him with The Village called Lady in the Water. There's the really incomprehensible Nature Fights Back movie, The Happening, which I've put now on 3 or 4 separate Shocktober lists of movies to watch because I keep wanting to see that movie, but I fall asleep in the first half hour and then never make it to the end. But I just really want to see it because I know it's supposed to be incomprehensibly bad.
The thing that I know about that movie has always made me want to know what that movie actually is.
Right. Like I just it's a movie that I need to know, but I keep.
It takes a while to get to the happening. what other films would call plot?
Well, what happens is I fall asleep, unfortunately. Oh, gotcha. After the happening, really where he sort of like culturally sort of fell off a cliff was the whitewashed version of Avatar, The Last Airbender, which at some point, I've never seen Avatar, heard it's great. I'd love to have a reason to watch that movie. Like I just kind of like whizzed by me because it was so derided as being just a bad movie, even outside of the whole whitewashing of the cast. He did that movie After Earth that I don't even remember. I just know that Will Smith was in it.
Oh, was it the one with Will Smith and I've seen that. Jaden?
It's primarily a Jaden movie though, right?
Yes. It was a Will Smith headlining so his son, you know, like he's, yeah. Here's the, you know, shiny actor to try and bring his son.
That movie apparently was cool, I think.
Danger is real. Fear is a choice.
I haven't seen it in a million years, but I remember when I saw it.
We're gonna stick with Natalie's interpretation.
Natalie,
afterwards.
If you told me you knew Jaden Smith, I would believe you.
I got friends.
See.
Who know him?
See. See.
I'm connected.
And then sort of like tying this full circle to where what we've done so far with Begin to Rewatch It is that his career is kind of in a tank. He disappeared. He did a season of a Fox TV series that was sort of twins. That was very Twin Peaks inspired that I didn't watch and now I can't remember the name of and I don't have it here in my notes. But he more or less sort of like began his career comeback with a 2015 low budget horror movie called The Visit in collaboration with Blumhouse, which, you know, they produced all of the Purge films. And it's The Visit is a deeply effective, very good found footage film. If you like that genre, excuse me?
Bless
Wayward
you.
Pines, by the way.
Wayward Pines.
When you said that, it was Twin Peaks inspired. I was like,
and I've heard the first season
like
is legitimately
movie.
Good.
That show, yeah.
And then
Matt
it goes.
Matt Dillon's in that. Yeah, okay.
Mm-hmm. I've heard it's like
Matt
all
Damon.
Right.
Matt Dillon, different Matt.
Oh.
The energy of this room will not stop.
This is the punchiest room of all time.
I've never been this punchy in my life.
I love to be punchy.
It's a different day than the Monday. I want to be clear.
Oh, Matt Dillon, not Kevin Dillon.
Oh, my God.
Drama.
And that takes
us
to 2017's Split. Also an interesting movie that has some really questionable plot decisions.
I have not seen it.
Health.
I know the twists in it, but...
Yeah, we don't want to get there yet.
Okay.
We might watch that movie.
We should.
Okay.
To set up Glass.
Yeah.
Which early reviews of Glass are not probably.
It's,
like,
it's classic M. Night in the bad way.
I'm seeing Glass this weekend. So I got to see Split. Like, okay, what?
You have to see Split before you watch Glass. Like, it's a requirement.
Well, I have to watch The Sixth Sense now.
No.
I don't think it's connected.
Well, you actually, look, are you seeing Sixth Split Sense. With people, with Glass with people?
Yes.
Yeah, you're going to have to see Sixth Sense if you don't want it spoiled. Because somebody's going to be like, oh, it's just
you're
like
right.
in.
You're right.
So, yeah,
oh,
sorry, you've
shit.
Got, you have a little like
bit
one
of
day, 2 day long M. Night Film Festival in your future.
I cannot wait.
An M. Night Film-a-lon.
It's so good.
So anyway, so that's Unbreakable. I'm curious. I did not, despite being a big M. Night fan, especially like his early horror stuff that definitely vibed with me as a kid, and especially as a big X-Files fan, like he was slotted right into my wheelhouse. Didn't have a history with comics as a kid, so I sort of just skipped past Unbreakable and never went back to it. So I'm curious what everyone else's sort of like either history with the movie was, or if you had anything interesting about your own like relationship with M. Night and his films, and just generally, you know, what folks, you know, thought of the movie Unbreakable. So given that, Natalie, you thought Bruce was hot and then it all took a turn, like, what did you make of the movie?
Well, my first introduction to M. Night Shyamalan. Yes, M. Night Shyamalan. Was when he spoke at my freshman orientation.
What a twist!
I can't fucking believe it! Continue.
What did he say? Did he spoil the Sixth Sense?
Well, he told you where the dining hall was.
Okay.
He told you where to pick up student IDs and what buildings to give you access to.
Dean.
Oh, so in the same way that M. Night is a cameo in all of his films, he also was just gonna, he was just camoing as like a, helping the students get around the class.
Yeah, I mean, he did tell us, God, I can't even remember. I remember being very confused. I remember being very confused, and oh, he did talk about the fact that he had like strippers in his dorm room at one time.
The David Cage of movies has signed
cool
on.
Story.
And then I was like, I don't know about this guy. And then, so I've never seen Unbreakable before. This is my first time watching it.
Oh, okay.
And I guess I've seen After Earth and Stuart Little. That's the...
It's extremely good that you have not seen any of the formative films in the M. Night canon, but you have seen Stuart Little and After Earth.
Gen Z, you know?
Wow.
Did you like it? Did you like Unbreakable?
Yes, I liked it. I thought it was okay. I thought it was fine. I thought it was a fine. I thought it was an okay, fine film, and I thought it did some interesting things, and then I thought it did some bad things. But ultimately, it did make me want like more of this story. So I guess in that sense, it was successful. So like the characters it did introduce in terms of like the principles of. Played by Bruce Willis and Samuel Robin Jackson Wright. And Robin Wright and Little Kid.
The kid that you think is the kid from The Sixth Sense for kid. Like a good couple of minutes
yes.
And then nope, just a different kid.
I did think that for a long
here.
Time.
I have a note here that just says, this is not Haley Joel Osment.
No, the opening shot of that kid though, right?
Oh,
like,
yeah.
You well, think look. It's him.
M. Night, like, he's just like, I need give me the biggest, wettest eyes possible.
Ew.
And could you just play this scene with your jaw just a little slacker and just look just more stunned, please? More stunned. That seems to be sort
more
of the direction
stunned,
he
please.
Gives.
God.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, Samuel Jackson just gave an interview about Glass where he said, well, what's like, you know, you've been in M. Night's films for a long time. What's like, how has he changed over the years? He's like, well, he's less of a dictator. He's like, well, what do you mean by that? He's like, well, he was one of those directors that he didn't really want you to act. He wanted you to read what was on the page. And he'd come over and tell you specific words that you didn't emphasize that were supposed to be emphasized. Mm. And he's like, you know, that awfully confident director to go up and tell Samuel Jackson, like, yeah. Hey, hey, motherfucker, you're emphasizing the wrong word in this script.
Yeah.
I mean, so... I had this whole arc as I was watching Unbreakable because, like, when we were prepping for this episode, I was tempted to not watch the movie. I was like, I know Unbreakable. I've seen Unbreakable
what?
A bunch. I don't need to see Unbreakable again because I don't like Unbreakable that much.
Right.
Oh, so you mean you weren't going to rewatch it? You had already seen it. And you were not going
no,
to...
Oh, yeah,
Rob
yeah.
Was, Rob was going to bullshit his way through the conversation.
Taking advice from
I was going
M.
to freshman studies.
Talk.
Yes.
Yeah, Unbreakable. Yeah, exactly.
No.
I really think so, the shot composition said a lot about masculinity, I think. heroism.
Yeah.
But it's open to interpretation.
Yeah, obviously.
The mundane.
So, no, like, I felt like I had a pretty good sense of this movie, and I knew what I thought of it. And I wasn't really excited to watch it again. As I'm rewatching it the other night, I'm sitting there, and for the first hour, I would say, I'm sitting there being like, damn, this movie is so much better than I remembered. This movie is superb. Like, it is such a graceful and just well-crafted film. It is so... The way to put it is, it's playing with heavy things, but they land softly in a lot of places. And then we get about halfway through the second act into the third, and I begin to remember why I do not remember Unbreakable all that fondly.
The last 30 minutes, right?
Yeah, pretty much. Like, the movie becomes, like, less interesting as sort of the central mystery is resolved. And also, it just culminates in a series of really tacky portrayals of David's, like, superpower and, like, the yeah. things he chooses to intervene on and chooses uh-huh. not to. Yep. And then that culminates in a really terrible actionless action sequence, which is completely mishandled on multiple levels to the point where it almost seems intentional, but I don't think it is. I think just one reason Shyamalan, I suspect, is really good at building suspense is because he don't know how to pay it off. Mm-hmm. And so that's why you have a twist, you are bailed out from ever resolving the tension and conflict you've been establishing. But my God, when he actually has to show like action, kinetic action in a film, suddenly all those comparisons to great directors, Spielberg was a name he was compared to a lot when he was a young director, all those comparisons fall apart because he does not make those moments land. It completely misfires. So it was weird. Like Unbreakable, on the first like two-thirds of that movie, I was like, damn, this movie's a classic.
Yeah.
This is tremendous. And the last third of it really sours me on both a, you know, aesthetic level, but also a moral one.
There is two things. One, I think the thing that struck me while I was watching this time was I loved this movie when it first came out. I was a big M. Night Shyamalan fan after Sixth Sense. I loved Unbreakable when it came out. I was like, as a young comic book fan who was, you know, in 2000, I was 15, so I was like perfectly poised to want mundane and real things, right? In that moment of like, I want there to be realism, and I want there to be a superhero story that focuses on family and focuses on character more than blah blah blah, which is like obviously dismissing years of comics that had already done that. Or I would say I was getting into comics that were exploring that stuff and had explored that stuff. So to see Unbreakable at the time was really fantastic, especially coming off of years of superhero movies that were swinging hard the other direction, neon and brightly colored and cartoonish. Yeah, exactly. And so at the time I loved it. Coming back to it, I thought I knew what I was getting into because I'd loved it as a kid. But I'd forgotten so much about those first two thirds of the movie that Rob is talking about. Specifically, I'd forgotten the pacing of the film. Like, it is a slow and steady rollout of what's happening. Like, not much happens. Yeah. And I will say, maybe to discredit a little bit, is I'm not sure why certain things do happen. I don't understand why Willis's character continues to remain in touch with Sam Jackson's character outside of some intuitive sense that he is different. But they don't, I don't buy it for many of those scenes. But what I do just love is the slow realization that comes over these characters. There are a number of set pieces early on that we'll get to as Patrick walks us through the movie, I think are real high points of small moment tension being paid off. But by the end, my takeaway, and this is where the David Cage connection actually comes together for me, is there are concepts here that are fascinating. That if I told you what this movie, one, I could tell you this whole movie in four sentences, right? Like, there is not much action here. The plot is minimized. And though that four sentence version of the story is actually fascinating. It's like, wow, the concepts at work here are incredible. This guy's name is Mr. Glass. Like, all of that stuff is just, like, immediately recognizable as, like, something with potential.
Yeah.
But the way characters are squandered, the way Willis's wife just vanishes from the film in the final third, just completely vanishes, literally after a point at which the lack of resolution is kind of introduced. And then just in general, the sense of like, there's one real big final payoff at the very end of this movie, and the road to get there is just, it's paved with bullshit in a way that it doesn't feel earned. It doesn't necessarily feel like it had a direct connection to what the action of the final act is. And again, like, that feels like one of those situations where I could sense that Shyamalan had that ending and had the beginning, and the two things connecting there were just like, oh, I'll figure it out. And it just doesn't, that part didn't work for me. But I still enjoyed my time with it, is what I will say. I think, Rob, last night you said in chat, Sam Jackson has never looked more stylish, which is saying something. And it's
the hair
true.
In this movie.
The hair, the suits.
He's beautiful.
The fucking purple. Oh.
Yeah. That sparkly collar yes. underneath the yes. like
the little bit of color that he's got going on, just a little bit of purple. It's not,
so
you know,
good. It's
not
so
over the
good.
Top.
It's
yeah.
great.
Yeah, I think that the pace of the movie is really the thing that came to me, especially given the pace of comic book movies these days, even origin story, right? Like things are so snappy, or in the case of like modern Spider-Man, like just skip the origin. You just go right into the middle of the career of these characters. And I think that's what makes like the last third, you know, we'll get to the specifics of that, like so jarring to me as well, was because it's a hard left turn that feels like, oh, right, this is what needs to happen now because this is what happens in the origin story. Whereas like this movie is trying to subvert in some ways, or at least like walk through that origin story, it would have continued that slow place and just brought those characters to a resolution and then set up for whatever it attempts to do in the third act in a subsequent film and explore that at a similarly labored pace. Because otherwise, like, yeah, that first act, I love how much time they spend with, you know, Bruce Willis and Robin Wright and, like, give them, like, time to breathe as characters. But, yeah, they don't get resolution towards the end.
So it's interesting mm-hmm. to me. Patrick, you talk about the movie opening. When I think about the movie, I think about it opening on a train. And I forget, every time I see this yeah. movie, I forget that it opens with a title card.
Yes.
And
I mean, title card
flashback,
is fascinating.
And a flashback to a department store in Philadelphia yeah. in the 60s. Like, I always forget that the movie does not open on the train. And it is interesting to me that the framing device of the film indicates from the first, whose story is this?
Right.
Because it feels like the movie has two beginnings. And it is so interesting to me. Like, I laughed when I realized, like, I don't remember the scene at all.
I don't remember any
of
the flashbacks.
Where's the train?
At all. I didn't remember any of the flashbacks with Mr. Glass. And on rewatching them, I think that's strange because of how well they're all shot and how well they all do a very specific thing, which is they shoot in reflection. I don't know if that was like an obvious thing, but the opening scene of his birth is shot in the reflection of a full-length mirror. When it jumps ahead and it's the conversation about him needing to go outside, it's in the reflection of the television. He is always shot in glass in all the flashbacks, and that culminates with him being shot in glass in his own art studio in the reflection of the piece he's selling to the guy who he's going to give it to his four-year-old kid, and he just loses it.
Great scene.
It's very good.
But
it's weird how that be, at least between that and his previous film, The Sixth Sense, like that is like a, not quite a trope at that point, because I don't think it continues necessarily going forward, but the notion of, you know, aiming the camera and the things in the foreign background
yes.
representing things is critical to The Sixth Sense in a non-obvious
yeah.
way.
Signs does some of that too, yeah. I think, actually, now that I think
it
about it.
It does, but not nearly to the degree that
these first
Sixth
two.
Sense hinges on it and like, the glass or Unbreakable.
But, Signs depends on the reflection, like, under...
You didn't say you saw Signs.
I forgot to say that I saw Signs.
Oh, my God.
I just
in
watched it,
order?
Actually.
In what order? Yeah.
Okay.
What's the order of Signs?
First movie I saw was probably Stuart Little, then Signs.
Hell yeah.
Okay.
Then After
okay.
Earth, and then I saw
right.
Signs, like, a couple months ago.
Okay.
Again.
Okay.
So that's why I remember it.
I was confused.
But there's the
okay.
glass, and there's, like, the... There's,
yeah, yeah.
Seeing
yeah.
it in the...
You're right. You're right.
There's a lot of reflections and...
Yeah.
He had an obsession with symbolism
yes.
That just became less pronounced.
And I think
like the symbolism started happening more in his characters in
yes.
weird ways with like Lady in the Water and stuff like that, as opposed to happening in the cinematography, which was an obsession that is probably related to, you know, his love of Spielberg and stuff like that. So, but yeah, like I want to just read this bit that it opens on, which is like this really strange,
it's so weird.
The movie that you get Touchstone Pictures. And then before you get like written directed by M. Night Shyamalan, anything about the movie, it says black screen. It says there are 35 pages, 124 illustrations, the average comic book. A single issue ranges in price from $1 to over $140,000. 172,000 comics are sold in the U.S. every day, over 62,780,000 each year. The average comic book collector owns 3,312 comics and will spend approximately 1 year of his or her life reading them. And I saw that and went like, is this setting me up? Does this person hate comic books, or do they love? Like, it's a very strange message to send at the start of the movie, because it's not like conveying like a deep love of like the cultural institution of an ignored medium relative to film. It's just like a bunch of strange facts that come across a little bit like it's throwing shade, but like not explicitly. It's just strange.
I don't know if it's throwing shade. It's almost, it feels like the same sort of conversation that like I've been in the room of like video game conferences that are like pitching to like random like PR execs or whatever and are saying like, video games made over like more than, you know, movies and whatever combined this year. Like it feels like that same, like almost attaching,
like a
attaching
justification.
Yeah,
for, like,
exactly. A justification,
the reason I'm
like,
making a comic book fucking movie is because they're important.
Is because because obviously there's like not if there's a financial significance, there's going to be like a cultural significance as well.
That was definitely my read, and then it also I think ties into the speech that Mr. Glass. That Elijah gives halfway through the movie, right. In which he's like, "Pictographs, man, pictographs, man."
Yeah, that was.
Which I'll read. Like, I have that written down because I think that speech is super weird. But I think there's like a degree to which he's trying to say, "Look at the breadth of creation in this form. Must there not be something true in it? If this thing is so important to so many people." Like, on one land, I'm with Natalie that it's a prestige thing that's like, yeah, look, ghost stories, you know ghost stories are cool. Comics are also cool. Superheroes are also important. But I also think there's a degree to which he's trying to say, like, the fact that this resonates, 3,312 comics are, you know, are owned by the average comic collector. That's a lot of comics. Certainly, there must be something real in there. Mm. But I also was really taken by it. Like, I thought it was a strange way, a very defensive way of starting the movie. It was my read.
Well, yeah. In some ways, like, shades the character of, you know, Elijah, Mr. Glass, and their, like, if on one hand, you're saying, like, there must be something in them that is interesting and resonates, like, with the human condition, but then the character who enjoys comics is presented as Mr. Glass, like, feels, like... Like, if Mr. Glass is, like, the comic nerd who's obsessed and then defines their entire life through this medium, and then, ta-da, right? Like, that's, like, a strange, like, through line, like, that, like, undermines, you know, Austin, your interpretation of, like, how this opening, like,
totally.
Tag is presented.
Totally.
I mean, I think it's actually a problem for the movie, because at the end of it, I don't know why this, like, I still don't know why this text exists up front, because what that text suggests to me is that what Shyamalan is proposing is that there is an iceberg.
Yeah.
And we see the tip of it. Mm-hmm. And we do not understand the entire shape of the thing. Like, they range in price from $1 to $140,000. This indication that we don't know what comics are. We can't actually make a definitive statement about them. So we think of them as basically, you know, recycled paper garbage, but some become treasures. Some, like, comics fans dedicate a year of their life to this. That's the average. What about the super fan? What does it say when people are devoting years of their lives to a medium most people barely ever think about? And I think back when this movie was made, this was a lot more provocative because we didn't, like, think about how the resonance of the shot in the comic book shop with all the Thor comics and Spider-Man comics. Think about how the resonance of that image has changed between when this film was made and today, right? In when this movie is made, Thor, Spider-Man, these were like Marvel names you knew, but like you didn't know much about them. Certainly, you knew maybe the broad outlines, but they were comics.
Or
you weren't cultural.
I might know about them, but our grandparents didn't. Our uncles, our aunts, our cousins, like maybe we were the nerds. Who were like, oh wow, that was Thor in the background. But like the person you were seeing that movie with didn't know who the fuck that was, or if they did, it was from a cartoon from the mid-70s, very briefly.
It's the only time the movie pulls in outside. Yes. It's a very specific moment where it's like it's a comic book movie that makes no references to comics that exist until like that specific scene in of itself.
Well, and it's set up the shot of that comic store is cramped. It's like low rent. It contrasted to Elijah's high end dealership model.
Prestige. Like adds like an air of like making Elijah on this like pretentious like other level than like
legitimacy in some way.
Yeah.
Or like pursue presumed legitimacy. Now those brands are all worth a fortune.
Yeah.
And the world has given Elijah, in some sense, what he's wanted. The recognition that, that these things mean something to people and that there is truth in them. And
well, that there's,
blah,
like,
blah, blah,
value.
Right. Because, and that's weird.
Because it's not just about, like... Because the fact that he, like, denies it to the four-year-old, I think, is, like, very significant.
Yeah,
because
yeah. You're right.
Even though, like, this is not to be enjoyed by... Like, this is high art. You know, like, this is, like, some, like, higher thing. This is not, you know, your Spider-Man cartoon or whatever.
Right.
And so I think that is significant in, like, distinguishing this from the other. Distinguishing what
from the
Elijah
comic
is
or whatever.
Doing
yeah, yeah, yeah.
From the comic book store.
Well, the other interesting part is... Does Elijah actually like comics that much? He collects them,
yeah,
but
right.
That speech he gives as he examines the artist's original like cover
yeah.
design before it was like finished and colored for print. And he talks about how it all got flattened and exaggerated and cartoonified by the time it was printed, just like comics always do. But
yeah.
The image that compels him is the comics that couldn't be made in the golden silver age, right? It's the artist's vision, the belief that there is a truth, there is a different version of comics underneath the surface of the debased items that we receive. It's a weird, there is a weird comment being made about comics and comics fandom in this movie that I don't think is well articulated, but it's interesting.
I question whether it even has much to say about that, right? Like, I don't even know if there is a, like, operating theory in the movie that's presented.
I think the movie is an operating theory in that
the movie, I mean, like, the character of Elijah and what he represents
totally, but
is, like, fandom. I don't think that is, like, an operating
I don't think it's
theory.
About fandom, but I do think the stuff that Elijah says in that sequence where he's, like, and notice that, like, the chin isn't as big and that mm-hmm. things are, he's doing the thing that's, like, Unbreakable is a better superhero movie than Batman Forever. Like, that's the thing he's saying is, like, we shouldn't have nipples on our Batman suits. And, like, slamming his hand on the ground. The longest form thread in existence. Written by Elijah.
Closed after him.
He just hates the fucking... He hates George Clooney as Bruce Wayne. He just hates him. And I think that is maybe one of the through lines. And that it does think that... its style of storytelling is a little more real. You know, there's the moments where Elijah says, like, things don't fit into little boxes in real life, David. And, like, that is his that is his version of saying, like,
Marie
things are
Kondo
a little more complex.
Would fucking
yeah.
disagree.
Absolutely.
Stay tuned.
Yeah. We could say that's the best place for them.
I still don't know where she gets those boxes. I don't know. That is her superpower.
So I've gotten some tips.
Okay.
Don't want to burn pot.
We'll talk about that in another day. Anyway.
Well, let's. There was a couple scenes I wanted to walk through. People, you know, bring up your notes as you come along.
We should take a break.
Get to. Yeah, let's. We'll take a break and we'll start walking through the film. We'll be right back.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
And we're back. We're going to start kind of walking through the movie itself, which I think I'll touch on a bunch of the different themes that reactions people have had to the film. We alluded to the open. We spent a lot of time on some fucking text that doesn't necessarily have to do with the plot. But like the moment that then cuts to, you know, my impression as someone that had not seen the film before was like, this movie's going to open. It's me on a train. Yo, that train's going to crash. Let's go. Yeah. Like, let's watch this train crash. And... it actually opens on a scene where David is slumped over. He is wearing a suit that doesn't exactly fit especially well. David's not taking care of his style. And I believe at the beginning is kind of like playing sort of like peekaboo with a child who is in a seat in front of him. And that's like the perspective of our camera is like set between, it is going back and forth between like the gap in between the seats. And then the camera ends up resting there generally from the perspective of what could be that child.
Yeah.
When a woman sits down, like as she puts away her bag, like exposes her midriff, which shows a tattoo, which then immediately prompts David to take off his wedding ring, put it in his pocket, and start a not particularly good charm offensive to try and talk to this woman. And the framing of this scene in which the camera stays steady in a single shot, no cuts, where we're from that perspective of the child as he attempts to have a conversation with this woman that falls apart in the most uncomfortable of ways. But I found it like a really effective scene at setting, you know, it's a superhero film. And so the idea that the opening moment of the film is that, hey, this isn't like a weakness. There's like a deep character flaw of this person. Like, here's your main character. They're supposed to be this is their origin story. That was like a fascinating way to like frame, shoot, and like set up like the character that we're going to see for, you know, the ensuing 2 hours.
He is, you know, you've written here, Patrick, that you end up feeling a sort of disgusted pity. And I think that that's pretty on point. Through the hospital scene that follows, like all the way through, you're just like, oh my God, this fucking dude. And it becomes clearer once you understand that he's separated from his wife. Like, this isn't him like trying to make a play at an affair or something. Mm-hmm. But there is still the degree to which he is, if he has any charm, it is under lock and key. He is such a restrained character throughout the film. And at this moment is one of the only moments that you see him try to like turn it on in the first half of the film and speak loudly. Otherwise, this is a character who mumbles constantly, who's very soft-spoken, who barely enunciates his words, which obviously plays off of Sam Jackson's character, Elijah, who is loud and
like super articulate.
Very, 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 like perfectly enunciates every word he says, says every syllable perfectly, mm-hmm. and has a commanding presence.
Yeah, totally.
And to see him just like swing and miss over and over again with this woman is like, oh, okay, I don't know that I'm rooting for him, but I'm gonna see what happens.
And it feels like a formula.
Yeah,
like
yeah,
it,
yeah.
It super is like, okay, yeah. What are like the three questions that that will get me to like the information that I need to see if like this is gonna
if
go
this is
anywhere.
A thing. Yeah.
Like,
he read them in Men's
where
Health.
Where are you going?
Like a second ago.
Yeah.
He like,
that was the other
I guess
magazine.
It's, yeah, because it wouldn't be a pickup book, right? Like, this doesn't exist at this point. So it's got to be
one of those magazines that he literally just read and put away. It says
he brings those magazines with him. Those are in his briefcase.
And then he sets them down. Yeah. But yeah, so it feels like not rehearsed, but like in the back of his mind almost, mm-hmm. Which, yeah, that was like the kind of the pathetic part. It was like, this is not like a genuine connection. And when you see that and they're talking about football, which you later learn is like was like his fucking life passion when he was pre-college or whatever, or at the end of his college career. And in that moment, he's like, I don't really watch football. You're like, why are you guys fucking even talking?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Hi.
I have to record what's happening.
Oh my God.
We have to fix this.
Everything is, oh.
We have to fix this.
We can see you just fine.
We need to, where's the sage?
I don't know. We have to exercise this room.
Oh my God.
Patrick, where are you in this? Ah! Okay, there he is.
Where am I?
I think you're over.
Oh, that's me.
Yeah, that's you.
Hi.
We can keep going. We just, video is bad.
Video's bad. It looks like you are in the ring.
Yeah.
In the TV.
We can see you, so I can still keep tabs on people if people have things to say and stuff.
Okay. Or we can just, like, why don't we just.
Yeah, that's fine. We'll do this over
why
here.
Why don't we just do this?
Okay.
Oh. I hate
this
it.
This is fine. This
okay,
is fine.
Okay, this is fine. Just,
okay. All right, we're
anyway,
good?
Sorry.
Okay. Go ahead, Rob.
Something I like here, and it's the way the camera is sort of peering and craning around to follow the conversation between them reminds me a lot of Fincher. And I don't think that's accidental. There's a lot of things in this movie that remind me of Fincher. The palette, the fact that basically, again, that last act, the movie at that point is fully turning into Seven right before your eyes. But I kind of like it. This feeling of like restless energy that permeates that scene. This slightly voyeuristic. I think this is what makes it especially uncomfortable. Is that, like, you feel like you are not meant to see this. Just this poor bastard just getting utterly humiliated by his own just dismal, shabby patter. But also the it already creates this weird sort of discomfort and suspense in a scene that is going to turn horrific, and you're already primed for it. Like, it already feels like bad things are already happening, even though nothing has happened yet. By the time she moves on, it already feels like something is just off. There's a wrongness to the scene. And as he sort of, drifts off again and goes back to staring out the window, the way suddenly the sound of that train, the persistence of the train horn, it's very effective. It was one of those moments where I realized this movie is a lot better and makes use of a lot more filmmaking tools than I remember it making. And I think one of the other half of this that really lands, having met this shabby failed dad, the scene later, after he is the only survivor, when he comes out of the emergency room and all those people are standing there and all the weight of their, like, it's from David's point of view, all the weight of their hopes and expectations and fear lands on you, the viewer, as these people like look at you, basically you coming out the emergency room as the only person who walked off that train, and they don't know it yet, but nobody else is.
Yeah.
And that moment, it hit me in the chest like a hammer. It is such an effective moment. And he gets reunited with his family, but right away there's that awkwardness of, it's a happy reunion, they're glad he survived, but also he might have been the most expendable person on that train for, you know what I mean? Like to a degree, he's coming back to his family that, to a degree, he's already wrecked that family. Like, he's coming back to a wife who doesn't know how she feels.
In another room.
Yeah.
when you find out that the reason he was on that train was because he was looking to go get a job in New York because he's about to leave that family. And like, I think that's part of what like is makes the first, third of the movie so strong is like, really, like, the A story is, like, learning how dysfunctional, like, he is and how he just does not fit into society, this family. Right. Like, he is just – he exists, but he's not really there. And the B plot is, this, like, slow burn discovery of, what he might or might not
there
be.
There is a – especially in the beginning, having – you place that set of sequences together with Elijah's origin and birth, literal birth, in which it's revealed that all of his bones are broken.
Oh, God. Moment,
which
was...
is like,
that, like,
fucked
just
me
like,
up.
As a side point, like, that, like, discovery was
it's
like
horrible.
The way they play that, the way that doctor. Specifically plays that, like, I was not
me
ready
either.
For how heavy that scene was going to feel.
Is this thing where. There's so much at work here, given the two characters, given their differences in physical capability, but also in race and a million different things, right? And also in economic, status by the kind of opening moments of the action of the film, the present action. They're different in all these key ways. And the one that seemed clear to me at this point in the film, and I don't know that it's true by the end, it's like, oh, this is a story about someone with survivor's guilt in David. Up against someone who has struggled and who has been traumatized from the moment they were born, in which the person with survivor's guilt has no way to justify his existence because he seems so unremarkable, and the person who has been traumatized has had to invent a reason for himself to exist because the world clearly doesn't want him to. Mm-hmm. And that is, like, there's something at play there. Though by the end, it ends up feeling more like a film about fulfillment and a film about...
like fate.
Fate, but also, it ends with Elijah basically saying... like, to not know your place in the world, to not know why you're here, that is the worst thing. And the thing that Bruce Willis, that David Dunn achieves is recognition that he exists for a reason, that he fits into people's lives. And the moments when he's able to do that are the moments when he stops mumbling and he stops feeling like he shouldn't be alive.
When the sadness is gone.
Right.
When he doesn't wake up.
And sad. I'm having a hard time still unpacking what to do with that idea. Given that, like, yeah, motherfucker, you're invincible. Of course the world has space for you in it. Like, that's not a victory for any, like, do you know what I mean? It's a little bit of The Incredibles 1 stuff, where it's like, am I really supposed to feel bad for the dude who was invincible and who had it, who was born with a genetic, like, strength? Versus this other dude. And I think the movie's playing with that. I don't think the movie is unaware that you're supposed mm-hmm. to be charmed by Elijah's predicament, and that you might be even wooed by his evil mastermind mm-hmm. ploys at the end. Rob, you were shaking your hands.
No, I mean, to a degree, the other uncomfortable thing running through this film is the degree to which this is, like, white male boomer resentment, the movie, in a lot of ways. This, when you're talking about, like, are we supposed to feel bad for this guy who has all these incredible powers? Like, look, Dave is a security guard. He's not living the high life.
No, absolutely.
Like that. But there's this. But the other thing in this movie is he's this middle-aged dude who's come. He's come to the midway point of his life, and he feels this deep, like, sadness and resentment at all the ways these other people constrained him, all these choices he made. He's like a fucking, like, George Bailey character, almost, where he has this sense of, I could have been anything, and I stayed here for all you fucking people, and what has it gotten me?
But he doesn't ever voice that, right? Like, that's the difference.
No,
he doesn't.
I don't know if he's so quiet and passive.
Yeah,
but that is true about his life.
Life just goes by him.
But that is true about his life. He could have been the best football player who ever lived, and instead he decided to have a family and to be a dad, and he's miserable. And the thing that ends up being his resolution, the synthesis at the end, is he finds a way to both have a family and get fulfillment by being a superhero. He, like, supplements his family life by being a badass, like, who, like, helps people. Yeah. You air quoted me, Natalie. But that is, like, the takeaway is, like, oh, you have to find fulfillment, but blah, 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 blah. But I do think that this stuff is potent and is charged once you start thinking about what the alternatives for that character's life could have been. And I think it's smart to not make him verbally resentful about it, because you would lose all empathy for him. And instead, what you do get is a lot of enjoyment when he does open up. I know, Patrick, another scene you wanted to talk about was the weightlifting scene, which is rad.
Yeah.
You just feel like, I don't know, for me, it made me feel... So my parents divorced when I was a kid, and... I very much cherish the moments when I felt proud of my father, who I only got to see once in a while, a couple days a week, or when he was working in other states once every few months or every few weeks. And, like, those moments would be like, that's my fucking dad. Yeah, that's awesome. Mm-hmm. That sequence really did, like, play for me.
Or the times that, like, my parents didn't divorce, but my dad was a salesperson for the large part of his life before he settled into sort of executive stuff, and he just wasn't around for... you know, first 10 years or so. And so it's like that scene where David, you know, his son is off playing football with all the kids. And this is right before the weightlift scene. You know, he doesn't want to get involved in playing football, but, like, the kid just wants to be recognized by his father. Like, there's this really promising that it doesn't, I like the final scene and how they play it, but there's not enough of this in the movie, despite the presence of the child, where, like, they work through, like, the validation recognition issues between, like, a father and son, or just a parent and a child. That's regardless of a father or a mother. But, like, I saw so much of myself in that scene of, like, not so much that my father ignored me, but just, like, the rare moments where you get to, like, be involved, a participant, like excited along with like a parental figure. And so like that's one of the moments where like, yeah, Shyamalan looking for like a dewy-eyed, wide-eyed kid and like just playing that up, like worked really well as that scene went along, because both he acts as a surrogate for the viewer and being like, you are the kid discovering the superhero origin along with them, but also just that relationship between a parent and a child, and that constant like looking for validation and interest and like a relationship that goes beyond just being like the authority figure.
And also I think there's something there about like inheritance, when the little kid is like clearly not as good at football, or like is not allowed to even play football, but is aware that like his father was a superstar, and also like has not inherited like the super strength as also a kid of divorce and my dad not being around a lot. Like sports was like that one, like my dad played volleyball in college and volleyball was my number one sport because I wanted like that attention and like that recognition. And so having my dad at like my volleyball games, whenever he was there, was like, this is like the time to prove myself. And like, that was so, so real for me. Which I wish that through that weightlifting scene, I wish that that had carried itself more through the movie, like that father-son relationship, just the parent-child relationship in general. The next time we get it is like in the gun scene,
the unearned gun scene, which itself is like dramatic and
tense, isolated
and, like, well
from the rest
well
of
done.
The movie,
but like it doesn't land character wise but if you were just to isolated watch that scene, it's fucking incredible. Like it's a really good scene, but I remember watching being like, well, this doesn't feel like an earned twist in like the, like this seems like overreactive for the kid. Like I didn't buy why it was happening, but the scene itself and the directing. And there are other scenes I want to talk about, but we just got the 15 minutes. So unfortunately, I'm going to
just briefly imagine dialogue options floating around that sequence.
Yeah.
And it has triangle, square, circle. Yeah. And what are you saying? You know it's a David.
I'm going to leave. I'm going to leave.
Exactly. You hit the I'm going to leave button.
Bully. Intimidate. Just the thing I do want to call it real quickly.
Yeah.
When the movie gives Robin Wright stuff to do, she is great with it. The scenes, they get across so well that feeling of a couple that has hit a crisis and is feeling their way through it. And I've seen couples come out either end of that in different places, but like they nail that weird vibe of affection, loyalty, and like fear.
Weariness.
Yeah, and weariness. Yeah. And that, like, all those scenes are just gorgeously played. Again, there's so much in this movie that like is beautiful. And then we begin getting to the last act.
Yeah, so I just want to, unfortunately, just because of time constraint, want to get us towards, I think, you know, to unpack as much as the sort of final turn of the movie, in which, you know, he realizes he's, you know, got these powers, and then, you know, he has this conversation with Elijah where he's like, well, you know, go do something about it. So he, you know, we awkwardly discover that, like, he can kind of, like, pick up either through intuition or touch, like the communication, the language of his powers is not fully communicated, that like creates like some weirdness, like is the beginning of the weirdness of the final act. He goes to a train station and begins like getting glimpses of other people's lives. And we are like getting glimpses into a whole range of crimes that he could do something about, from, you know, very petty crimes like, you know, stealing some jewelry, to the one that he ends up choosing, which is like the discovery of someone had approached a house, a familial house, you know, killed the father. Go ahead, Rob.
I mean, this is where the entire thing starts getting really uncomfortable really fucking fast. Like, I think what was being...
Random date rape thing that he just like moves on from. Like, yeah, right. Not worth going after that guy.
I think what he's going for is the sense of like, oh gosh, what's that scene? Is it a Jim Carrey movie where like briefly he gets to hear like every prayer that God is receiving all the time?
Bruce Almighty.
Is that it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's this overwhelming like sad cacophony, like all these prayers just flooding in, all these people who need you and you can't be there for all of them. I think that is sort of what the scene is trying to get across, that... This is the part that is, this is the horror of his power, is that he cannot be in all places at once. He cannot do all things. What it ends up coming across in the scene, though, is the hierarchy of bad things that could happen. And the it's fucking Goldilocks of homicide,
and then
basically.
Still includes, like, sexual assault in the horror of, like, the one that he chooses.
Yep. Yeah, definitely sexual assault's implied there. Also, it looks like there's a hate crime that he passes over to. A bunch of dudes in a pickup assaulting a black
family. Oh, yeah, they go back to Africa. Yeah.
So, like, just not that one. Not gonna deal with that one. The home invasion horror show. That's the one he's going to intervene in. And it's just, the way it comes across is this icky, like, fucking automat of crime that he's going to. And he's picking out the one most deserving of his attention. I don't think that's intended, but it is how the scene comes across. And then it sets up what ends up feeling like both an incompetent action sequence finale and a really grimy one.
In which he is going up against a malicious, sociopathic janitor who is already in Prison Orange, who is never developed as a character, who is just sort of walking hate. And, like, it is so weird to, from there they go to the bit where the mother sets up, oh, there are two types of villains. There's the soldier villain and there's the mastermind villain. Motherfucker, this is not the soldier villain. This is an empty vessel for you to place David's heroism into.
Yeah.
He's the taxidermist.
He never speaks.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. The villain never speaks and is just this walking entity of evil. And that was like so fucked up for me, is like what the true evil is, and how it's like the acts of true evil that David is like looking through as he touches everyone when he's in the train station, and like that hierarchy or whatever, and that how it's just without a voice is also the coloring in that scene of how everyone is in like just neutral colors,
in
and then
the train scene.
Not only in the train scene, but everyone he touches that happens to have like something bad associated with them is in like some brightly colored.
Oh, you're right. It's like orange or the bright green.
It's like the bright camo. It's like the bright camo red. Jacket. The bright red of the lady who like stole the necklace or everything. Like that was interesting.
Yeah, there's a degree of which, like, that whole sequence... First of all, I mean, the funniest thing about that whole sequence is the music playing during it. This extremely late 90s, like, trance, like...
Yes.
And then I want to be clear, like, it isn't only that the villain doesn't get development that bugs me. It is also that, like, again, we're using women as kind of disposable props for heroism. For like, Bruce Willis gets to be
the hero. And she's dead.
Oh, like the mom in the home invasion. Oh, she's like garbage on the floor. Yeah, like literally,
she's already dead. Yeah. Like in the newspaper article, it says like both of the parents died.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I do love the quotes around hero. The newspaper article: hero saves family. Well, not the family, the kids, I guess.
Yeah.
Save them.
Yeah. He hates water. Be careful.
When
okay,
it's just bad. It's bad plotting too, right? Like it's just there are so many easier ways to imagine the application of his power to being like discovering something about his boss at work or something. You know what I mean? Like it's a really strange.
Yeah, I do think the way that he like fumbles through the process is like makes sense in the context of his character. Like the fact that he's getting thrown around, it is like he's not like stealthing his way through the house.
No,
he's just walking.
I liked that it was a bad action.
I think that's what I'm saying, for me he's a fucking regular ass dude. Like even in the moment that he rescues his later to be wife from the car, like after he rips off the door off the car, it's not like he's like, whoa, he's just like he just grabs her and he's like with her and like isn't even thinking about what just happened. It's just
the world where they cast Keanu Reeves as this character and he just goes, whoa. Extremely good.
I wish
but the thing where the scene falls apart, though, is, like, for me, well, in addition to sort of the ickiness of it, but the fact that, like, Superman, basically, we've seen him rip a door off a car. He basically spends like 15 minutes choking this dude out from behind and like just put him through like something, some comic book thing needs to happen here, and it just doesn't. And it'd be fine, like the fact that it doesn't is effective, except for the musical score in that moment is so fucking like heroic and like triumphant, and the entire
But that's a lot.
What if the scene had no music, right? Like, I feel like there are better ways to like.
Pan.
But like, there is a way to, I think that the soundtrack doesn't accompany that properly, because like he is doing a quote unquote heroic act, but in a way that is just like, because I'm with Natalie, like I found like the apprehensive way he approaches the whole thing, where it's like he's just like fumbling his way, even the way he tries to untie
he's not like ripping it and like he's like
like he clearly like fucking has no idea what he's supposed to do, because like, and that's, I think that's a relatable feeling for someone that was attempting to do something like this, but yeah, like it doesn't line up with the heroic soundtrack that goes
but that's Elijah's point, is like all of that flair is exaggeration, right? Is like if there was that comic book moment, then this would just be that comic book movie, right? So like Elijah's whole thing is like these are instances that can be exaggerated to create like spectacle and like a fantastical whatever, but what they might really look like or like in the real setting, what they look like could be, and I don't know if that fucking lands for me.
I wish he made that case a little bit better, because when he does do it, he does the bit where he's like, I believe comics are our last link to an ancient way of passing on history. The Egyptians drew on walls. Countries all over the world still pass on knowledge through pictorial forms. I believe that comics are a form of history that someone somewhere felt or experienced, and then they got jazzed up and titillated.
Yeah, that was such
a are you saying that pictures are like, he didn't, the case that I remember from watching this was like, oh, comic books are a modern mythology, blah, blah, blah. But the case he actually makes is that, like, pictures tell stories. And I, like, yeah, they do. That's a thing everybody still does. It's not a lost.
But that there's the stories that they tell are the ones that are, like, have been carried through time.
Through time.
Like, these are the only lasting true stories that we can rely on. Better.
Yeah. And yet, I still think Sam Jackson is my favorite part of this movie. The delivery of the finale, of the final bit, is still like fucking bone chilling, still like hair raising. I love that reveal.
We live in mediocre times.
We live in mediocre times is such a good line.
Totally.
No, he's, I mean, look, he is at the top of his game in this movie. Like, and some of the compositions, that scene in the gallery where he's talking to David, and we just hold that distant shot by the chandelier, and Jackson is just a shape and a figure at the end of the shot, and a voice. And it's so, this is the thing that Shyamalan does very well in this movie, is like, there are moments you can see the comic book that this is.
Yeah.
In his composition.
Yeah. I think the colors of that sequence are the probably that too, right? The like bright colors of, right, we can't, this sorry, our studio space has
HBO.
Has HBO playing in the background.
All the time.
And
is this 16 Candles?
This is not 16 Candles.
This
I don't
is the
know
one with Drew Barrymore.
A lot of movies.
It's the one with Drew Barrymore when she's like an awkward teen.
Is she actually an awkward teen? She's an awkward teen. She goes back to college or goes back to high school.
I don't know.
That's never been kissed, right?
Yes,
never been
kissed. This has never been kissed.
And it's the condom scene.
Anyway.
Really useful sequence.
Ghost written by M. Night Shyamalan.
This podcast had to crash and burn in this exact way.
Yeah,
it had to.
So that's going to do it. There's so much more we could talk about, but...
we have to go record another podcast.
That's going
to
do it for our...
Stay tuned to the next one, which will be Split.
Yeah, to the next podcast. Yeah, right? So yeah, we're going to watch... we're going to watch Split. Yeah, we're going to do Split. And so that gives... By the time we watch Split and then get to Glass, that'll give people a couple of weeks to go out and see that movie, which comes out this weekend. That is going to do it for us here at Be Good and Rewatch It. You can follow everything that I do over at Patrick Klubik, at Patrick Klubik.
Austin_Walker.
Natalie.
At Natalie Watson.
Rob.
At Rob Zachney.
He ate the banana.
This guy just ate the banana
that
the condom was previously on.
Thanks to Tumelo for our theme music. You can find out More about what Tumelo does at tumelomakes.bandcamp.com. That is the number 2, don't spell it out. Or follow him over at MeloMakes on Twitter. You can keep up with all of us at waypointadvice.com. Please, this is a new feed. This is not in the normal Waypoint Radio feed. So, you know, like, subscribe, keep, you know, if you review it, that really does help us. So if you can take a couple of seconds, stars. If you can write an actual comment review, that's even better. But that's going to do it for us. I, you know, at some point I should write an outro.
This is good.
For this podcast.
Me.
But you know, just, you know what? If you
nailed it.
If you guys
nailed
it. Something you want to watch this weekend, you should just, you know, spend your time and be good and rewatch
it. That's good.
Aww.
That's
no,
bad.
That's it.
I don't know. I don't know if I can pull that off a second time. All right. <bye. laughs>
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
It's 4:30.
We're good. Danielle is entertaining them offsite. We have to. Right. We have to 5. We can okay. go to 5.
Okay. Cool.
Oh, I thought that was.
All
like
right,
a
we're
bit.
Back. Oops.
I'm sorry. I thought that was a bit from Rob. Like, it's 4:30, and I was like, yeah.
What's the bit?
What's the
know.
Bit? Isn't it? He would like. It would mean. That would mean something if you were like.
Rob hornily tells you the time. Classic Rob.
Time dot Rob.
Time dot Rob.
And Rob will hornily tell you what time it is, and then he'll pour you an appropriate drink. I would follow that Twitter bot.
Pat'll put this at the end.
I would too. That's a really good Twitter bot idea. Okay. Anyway, cut this.
Yeah, and put it at the end of the podcast. Yep. All right.
This room is haunted.
I like it. I got to be honest.
Me
the energy
too.
Off the studio is very different than Lobby One.
It's so different.
I'm into it.
Yeah.
It's 4:28.
So mad.
Oh my god. Rob, I don't know how that sound is going to come across just on audio.
I'm right here. You go ahead. You come back with this podcast whenever you're ready. I'm just
It's 4:28. I'm just drinking.
I was talking to the CEO of this company 30 minutes ago, and now Rob is making a horny voice at me.
Don't you love being the editor in chief?
So good.
Was that on the deck?
Yeah, it was on the deck. That was part of the presentation.
Okay. All right.
That was weird. It was good.
It was good.
It was weird.